Xian Chao grew up in China. He's a researcher at the University of Toronto, and he has been thinking about taking on what he calls an Anglo name, a name that English speakers in the West would know how to pronounce really easily. It's what his cousin did, it's what his aunt did, and his dilemma about whether to follow in their footsteps inspired some fascinating research in collaboration with a former advisor at the University of Kansas. His question was, do people respond differently on paper to white-sounding names? I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to hear that story now on KCUR's Central Standard. Xian Chao, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Tell me more about your dilemma. Why did you think taking on a name that sounds Anglo, as you put it, might be worth doing?
As a foreigner in the U.S., since the first day I arrived, I have been constantly asking myself this question. Should I adopt an Anglo name? And many times I feel if I anglicize my name, maybe my life will be better. For example, one time I applied for a research grant at the university, and after several months, I still hadn't received the results. So I contacted the review committee, and they told me they forgot to review my application. And similar things also happened at the conference. I received a travel award from the conference, which shows they like my work. But the conference moved my oral presentation a poster presentation without telling me before the conference. And not just in academia. Many times I feel people don't have eye contact with me when I'm in a group conversation. So maybe people don't know how to pronounce my name, and looking at me makes them feel embarrassed and uncomfortable. So I also have seen many Chinese international students and immigrants anglicizing their names, including my relatives living in the U.S. So I think this is an interesting intergroup and cultural phenomenon. And after talking with my advisor,
Can we slow down a little? Wait, sorry. I just want to talk to you more about this situation that you're facing, and we'll get to the research that you did. Yeah. You know, I went to college in the 90s. With a lot of international students, and several of the students from Asia did have Anglo names that they used with people like me, although it was clear they used other names with peers who were from Asia as well. And I was never sure where it was coming from. I felt bad for them because I didn't want them to be, you know, feeling like it was going to be too much work for me to learn how to say their names. At the same time, I thought maybe, though, this is enthusiasm for a new chapter in their lives. You know, I didn't want to step on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So one of the reasons they adopt Anglo names because they feel Americans, they are not able to pronounce and memorize their name. And also, maybe some other people may think if using Anglo name can avoid being discriminated. We have more evidence to support the first reason than the second.
So had you considered taking on an Anglo name before these opportunities were kind of stalling out on you? It is really bizarre to me, by the way, that anyone could just forget to review somebody's application.
Yes, I was really thinking about adopting an Anglo name. But based on our research, we also show that anglicizing one's name may also have negative consequences. For example, anglicizing name is associated with lower levels of self-esteem. So people who anglicize their name generally evaluate themselves lower than who don't anglicize their name. That's one consequence. Also, people may feel a loss of identity. Like my name, it means significant and outstanding. It has meanings. It defines my ideal self and also my the expectations from my parents. So if I use an English name like Alex, I don't feel it has meanings to me. And so when people call me Alex, it may lower how I view myself. So I decided not using an anglicized name. And also my advisor encouraged me to use my original ASCII name.
Well, so this question, though, about what your name as it appeared on paper might have to do with missed opportunities. What did you end up doing to turn that into a research question? How did you transform that into a project?
So we did our first study in a field experiment. So we just want to compare people's reactions to the same target by using different names. And field experiments allow participants to behave in a natural way, and the result can provide strong causal inferences. And we send out email to White American professors and why read the name of the sender. And I use my own name in this study. And there are two conditions. In the Anglo name condition, I mentioned in the email that my name is Xian Zhao, but you can call me Alex. In the original name condition, I said my name is Xian Zhao. You can call me by my first name, Xian. And we found that the use of an ethnic name led to fewer responses. Xian Zhao has 52% response rate, but Alex Zhao has 62%. And besides, White American professors were more likely to agree to meet with Alex than Xian, especially among associate professors. And in another experiment, we also found this name bias can change depending on a person's belief. University undergraduates evaluate Chinese teaching assistants who use their original name rather than anglicized name, but only among those who endorse assimilationism, who tend to think U.S. should only have one dominant culture and minorities should give up their cultural heritage.
So wait,
And yes,
can I ask you something? So you polled the professors you contacted on their general beliefs on this topic as well?
no, that's two studies. So in the first study, you only contact professors, see if they either respond or not, or see whether they agree to meet or not. In the second study, we measured University of Kansas undergraduate, their cultural ideology, whether they support assimilation or multiculturalism.
And so you compared those two studies to see that in an environment where the beliefs skewed one way or the other, that affected how people responded to what would be, I guess, a foreign sounding name, perhaps?
Yeah, so generally, if people they endorse assimilationism, so they were more likely to like the target, like the foreign visitor or immigrants who use an Anglo name than original ethnic name.
Were you able to follow up with people who did not respond to you when you said, "My name is Xian Chow. You can call me by my first name, Xian." Were you able to follow up and ask them, why didn't you respond?
A little bit. Because it's a study, we have to explain the purpose of the study after we complete it. So we send out an email with the goals and hypothesis of the study, and participants, faculty members, professors, when they understand the goal of the study, some of them they try to explain why they didn't answer respond. Some people say, I'm really busy, I usually don't respond to students requesting meetings like this. Or some people, they provide other justifications. But some other people, they didn't respond to me at all.
What do you make of those explanations? Do you think that that can account for a 10% difference in how often people responded to your emails?
No, it's hard to say. I think there are research or theories showing that people tend to find justifications when they show prejudice or discriminations towards others. So
They find a way of sort of
to
explaining it
justify.
away, yeah.
Yes. So it's hard to say whether that's the real reasons or that's just justifications for their behaviors.
Were you disappointed to discover that bias or relieved that it wasn't your work getting overlooked? I it's hard to say that that would be a relief, but I just wonder how you felt getting this information.
I'm worried, especially like now I'm on the job market looking for a new postdoc position for the next semester. And every time I submit my applications, I also still wondering whether I should put an Anglo name there in my CV or mention somewhere like in my cover letter. Should I do that? Every time I have been wondering. However, I decided not using Anglo name, because I feel we should not, as a scientist, as a integral relation researcher, I don't want to encourage minority to anglicize their names. But I do hope the society, the whole society, including members of the both majority group and minority group, to promote diversity and inclusion together. And actually, can I share that we are working on an ongoing intervention study, actually. So we are teaching people how to pronounce ethnic minority names. We simply train people to pronounce an ethnic name by showing them a YouTube video, and people can learn pretty quickly. Even though data collection is still ongoing, but preliminary results based on our pilot study suggest that learning to pronounce ethnic name may promote inter-ethnic interactions and communication.
How do you do that?
So,
I'm curious because I think like there are so many names out there, so it couldn't be name by name. How do you approach that big project of helping people figure out how to pronounce names?
So we have designed several studies. In this first study, we invited one Chinese international student and one white American student to come to a lab at the same time. But before we asked them to engage in a conversation, we put them into two separate rooms. And white American student, we show them the YouTube video to learn their Chinese partner's name. It's usually within 5 minutes, they can learn by themselves.
You know, you mentioned earlier some of the reasons why you don't want to change your name or use an Anglo name that you offer to people as like, you could always call me this if you wanted. And I understand all of those reasons. I am curious what it is that just big picture, what a name means to you, why holding on a name has value, even in the face of real life consequences that you might face. Lost opportunities, even possibly.
Yes, I can only speak to the Chinese name, I feel, because that's what I'm familiar with. Chinese name usually, it's not easy to name your kid. Chinese parents, they usually spend a lot of time, they look up the dictionary, because there are 5,000, almost 5,000 Chinese characters. And it takes a while to pick which name for their kids. And so parents usually put a lot of hope or wishes for their kids. And that conveys a lot of meanings. And when I grew up, I always try to behave like my name. I want to be outstanding. I want to become a significant person. So names has a lot of personal value to me. But if I use Alex, actually I don't know the meaning behind Alex. Maybe English speakers know, but I personally I don't know. And many times Chinese students they pick the name sometimes just because other people say this name is good for you. Or because when they learn English in China, their English teacher gave this name to them. So there's not a lot of meaning behind the name. So that's why I'm afraid to use Anglo name.
You know, you talked about this follow-up intervention study you're doing, but what do you think that the rest of us should do with this information, like outside of academia, just people listening right now? What do you hope they do with this information?
Yes, I hope people can not only study one language, but become interested in learning the basic of a variety of languages just for the purpose of pronouncing different names. And that's not that hard to do, actually. And people always have a stereotype believing that learning Mandarin, learning Chinese is a hard thing to do. And I don't feel the same way, even though I'm a Chinese speaking person, but I have seen so many like Americans in China, they after a while, after 1 year or 7 months, they speak Mandarin perfectly. And people always worry about the tones, like in Mandarin. They say it's hard to pronounce the tone exactly. But I don't feel tones are that important. Like when people say my name, like Xian, it's not exactly the same tone. My tone should be Xian. But it doesn't matter because I can still recognize people calling me. So I want to encourage like people just
Just
to
try.
try to learn, and you can ignore the tone. It doesn't matter that much.
Well, Xian Chao, thank you so
Yes.
much, and thank you for forgiving that I don't have the tones down.
It's fine, it's fine. Thanks for inviting me.
This conversation about the impact of anglicized names originally aired last February when Xian Chao joined us from the University of Toronto to discuss his research. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back, this time with Kansas City musician Calvin Arsenia, who spoke with us in September. Stay tuned. Calvin Sinha is a Kansas City musician, and it's hard to put him neatly in a box. That is part of his appeal. You can't pin him to a genre or even a specific instrument. He used to be known for being a harpist, but now his vocal stylings and sense of performance are at least as big a part of his signature sound and impression. Well, his new album, which he recorded with a star-studded band in California, is called L.A. Sessions. And you guys, this album is really good. Calvin Arsenia, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me about the making of this new album.
Well, the L.A. Sessions is... We revisited a few songs and then tried to do a couple new ones as well. And it was with my label called Center Cut Records. And they invited me to dinner and just asked me what my dreams were. And I kind of was pretty open with them and dreaming.
Yeah, what did you say?
Well, I said that, you know, one thing that I've been able to do a lot of is play with my friends. And I love that. And it's been a really... It's always a pleasure to work with them and to work with people here in Kansas City. But there's also a different kind of feeling of working with people in other parts of the world, and specifically in places where the industry is more rigorous. And so they said, you know, what is something that you have not been able to do yet? And how can we help you do that? And I said, well, I would love to record with some musicians in LA. And I kind of left it at that. And Jim Andrews went and found a producer. And
it sounds like... You know, like your fairy godmother appears and yeah. says, like, what do you want? You're like,
kinda, yeah.
I shall make it happen.
But there's also just something really beautiful about being open about your dreams and communicating them and, you know, ask and you shall receive, you know. And if you don't vocalize what it is that you want to do, then it will never happen. So
for an artist whose last album was such a love letter to Kansas City, I wonder if there's... any greater meaning in that, or no, just a new opportunity, a new...
Well, with the LA Sessions, I like to take life by the horns, and I love Kansas City, and I grew up in Olathe, and, you know, there's such an appeal to the openness that is here and to the ability for artists to make a name for themselves or to make a world for themselves and to make to not have the pressures of finances as much as it is on the coasts. You know, I have been lucky enough to be able to be a full-time musician and artist for the last 4 years and teaching here and there, but primarily, you know, all of my income comes from the stage. And so I'm grateful for Kansas City for that. And LA has a beautiful energy, and so does New York and other places as well. I've spent a lot of time in San Francisco, but Kansas City will also always be home.
As I mentioned just a little bit ago, there's some real star power in the band you recorded with. I understand your producer set that all up and you didn't even know before heading out.
I'm sort of... painfully oblivious, but I think I like to use that to my advantage, where I'm just taking people as they present themselves, and not for necessarily their track record. Although, you know, your reputation is important, but these are okay. All lovely men, so
which is wonderful that that's what you cared about. I do want to let our listeners know that you were recording with people who also played with Etta James, Aretha Franklin. Were you totally freaking out when you did learn that?
I just try to keep my cool. but what it comes to me, though, is that you have these amazing musicians who are humble and who are hardworking and who know how to get out of the way and to follow the muses. And I felt so much respect from them, and I felt so much camaraderie with them. I mean, we were laughing a lot during the sessions and just telling jokes and telling stories. And to me, that's the most important part.
So we're going to hear more about your story and what this album signals in your life and your career, but I think we better let our listeners hear some music. I want to play one of my favorite songs on LA Sessions. It's called Dying. Mm-hmm. Sounds morbid for a favorite, but whatever. Anything you want to say about this song before we play it?
Yeah, this song was first recorded for my album called Catastrophe, but this is a version, and I wanted to have it feel very soulful and very alive, and I think they did a great job.
Okay, let's listen to Dying from LA Sessions.
You'll have to scrape me off the ground. All these lies been bringing me down. and forced to act like I don't care. But I've been bleeding everywhere, and now I'm dying. I'm dying to love you. Yes, it's true.
Calvin Arsenia, this song sounds a little bit churchy to me, and I understand the church is a huge part of your background. Feel free to tell me if I'm imagining churchiness here, but I do hear a choir, and I wonder if you can speak to that.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up leading worship all over Kansas City, and Olathe in particular, and which was mostly playing acoustic guitar and singing songs in small groups of people. But the gospel influence, I would say, is more from my mother. And as funny as it sounds, she would play all of her favorite gospel music every Saturday morning when we had to clean the house.
That sounds like it would make the chores go by faster.
Yeah. But it's all just very, very emotional and passionate music. You know, people rendering their souls before an uncreated being, and so everything. I mean, the music, the drums, the organ, the singers, is with every fiber of their being. And I think that is something that's always inspired me as a musician and as a creative person.
You know, you've mentioned you're from Olathe, but you also spent some time in Scotland as an adult. And an article I read in The Pitch says that you kind of see your life as being divided into before Scotland and after Scotland. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Before Scotland, I was very, I don't know, I was very timid and very even more shy than I still am. And I was really looking for my voice and what my contributions were to whatever, just, you know, finding out who I was as a person. And my journey there, being around people who had also kind of left their families or left their home lives temporarily, a lot of young adults there who I call adult orphans, we were all just creatives kind of trying to find our place in the world. And
what were you doing in Scotland?
Yeah, my main purpose there was working as a missionary in a church. So I was there as kind of an outreach person, a liaison between a local body of Christians and the city. And my job description was to create or listen to stories and create art or events around people and using collaboration as a way to build bridges. And from that, I just really found that I was not living my true self completely, and I wanted to not be a hypocrite. So I decided to ultimately leave the church at the time.
Can you explain what you meant when you just said that you didn't feel like you were being your true self?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt that there were questions in my mind, and there were things that I you know, my lifestyle, particularly as a homosexual, was not invited into the Christian community that I was a part of, and I had seen so many people in the media be beheaded. I mean, socially, kind of, because they had come out later in life, and so I decided that I wasn't going to live that story, and that I would just do it on my own and find a community that would support me in that process, and I feel like I did the right thing.
So, how long did you stay in Scotland, and where do you feel like the sort of after part left you? You know what I mean? Like, what was different about Calvin after Scotland?
Well, Calvin before Scotland was happy to play acoustic guitar, singing in a corner of a coffee shop. And after Scotland, I'm singing on stages with circus performers as a consistent way of life. Just got back from Homer, Alaska with Quixotic, and that was awesome. I'm always playing with different genres of music, playing with different costumes and makeup and jewelry, and really just trying to live a life out loud, one that's not characterized by the shame that I was so familiar with.
There's another song from LA Sessions that I want to talk about. The song is Poseidon. It's got some really, really sexy stuff going on in it. And it is very overtly about a man. You're not leaving that to the imagination.
Correct.
Can you talk about doing that? That's a first for you, right?
Yeah. So for a long time, I used to write songs about men that I was interested in or was in love with, and I would change the pronouns because I was afraid to be seen. And this song actually, you know, and that is a lifelong, ongoing process. I'm going to just say that because when I was in the studio recording this song, there are parts of this song that I concealed until we were actually recording. And
when you say concealed, like you just when you were practicing, you didn't sing those parts?
Correct.
So did you have some master plan to just like?
Yeah, I just knew that the recording was the recording was going to be fine. I just didn't want to, I didn't want too much commentary. I just wanted to record the song, and so at least we got one take before before they started making. I mean, but everyone was lovely, so that and it's kind of just like, you know, an admission to being still very insecure sometimes, especially in a room full of strangers, and a room full of strangers of people who could, you know, have the prerogative to get up and leave, you know. So I just wanted to get the song down first
and not scare them off.
And not scare them off.
Well, let's hear Calvin Arsenia's Poseidon with that dramatic build-up.
Poseidon, you and your trident have been awful nice to me lately. You have a kingdom and a wife and a baby, but you make time every night. I can't stop thinking about you. I don't know what it is. You're just an ordinary man. Can't stop thinking about you. I don't know what it is. I don't miss the violin. I can't put my finger on it.
So, Calvin, we're not going to hear the last line in the song, but I feel like that's what you're referencing.
Yeah.
We'll let that be a surprise.
No, that'll be a surprise
for our listeners. But I am curious, you know, this room full of, like, as we've said, heavy hitters in the music industry,
yeah,
who are not of your generation. They're from more olden times, I guess, would be a way to put it.
Experienced.
Yeah, they're experienced. Yeah. And I wonder how they did react.
Yeah, I mean, so the last line comes and then we all just held our breath until the final sound was over, and then the engineer hit done, and then we all just burst out laughing, and it was really lovely. I mean, these guys are in LA and they've been in the industry. I'm sure that they've seen everything, and so nothing will actually surprise them. But I just felt insecure. That's that.
It seems to me that with your sound and your aesthetic, you have really created a kind of world of your own to inhabit. And it contains bits and pieces of so many different influences, but it doesn't feel like a patchwork of those things. It feels like its own separate thing. Like you put the church experience and the funk sound and a classical sound and the harp and even a little jam band-iness.
Yeah.
And you put them into some kind of chemical reaction, and now they're Calvin. And when it comes to some of the more challenging chapters in your story, I imagine that's incredibly healing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I often have said that and do say that in places or things that topics that I don't like to talk about in a one-on-one basis, they become very easy to talk about on the stage. And in the stage, it's designed that you present something and the audience claps. And so, whereas in a conversation, the conversation could go so many different ways.
And people rarely clap, although you just gave me the idea that would be a lovely thing to do more often. There are a few covers on this album, and I want to play one, Don't Explain. Talk to me about the song itself and what you did to come up with your own take on it.
As somebody that sings a lot of other people's music, I always try to really embody and feel the you know, all of the circumstances that would have been around somebody having to write this song. And to me, music is medicine, and music is healing, and music is like a salve for the soul. And I often imagine that different sounds and different language is like in little jars in the, behind a, an apothecary, you know, and that like as a mixture of them, they create the perfect tincture for whatever it is that ails you.
And so what's ailing someone when they write Don't Explain in your estimation?
I imagine that it says don't embarrass me. I know that you've trespassed, and I know that you've done things that you knew better than to do. We both know that. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to hear about it. Just don't embarrass me in public. And I don't think that there's a lot of songs that have this sentiment. There's a lot of songs that say you've hurt me or I love you, but there's not a lot of songs that say don't embarrass me, you know? And so I felt that this was a very powerful song, and progressive for its time. And, you know, Billie Holiday being the first artist to present it, and one of the writers as well.
So we will hear you singing this, but I want to say you at once absolutely don't sound like you're trying to be Billie Holiday when you're mm-hmm. singing the song. There are a couple of moments, though, where I feel you channeling her just for a split second. And sometimes it's in a note that just you're at one note and you just go a little bit lower for a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I just tried to feel it in my bones and sing from there, and to know that I will never be Nina Simone or Billie Holiday, and that, you know, what would they do? And they would just be themselves. And so I tried to do that.
Okay, this is Don't Explain, Calvin Arsenia's version from LA Sessions.
Quiet, baby, don't explain. You've got nothing to gain. Just skip that lipstick. Don't explain. You know that I love you, and my love endures. All my thoughts are of you. So completely yours. Don't wanna hear folks chatter, 'cause I know you cheat. Right and wrong don't matter when you're with me, my sweet. Hush now.
The vocal range on this song, you really get to explore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of, it sits in a higher place, but it's really gentle too, which is a new sound for me.
So when I talked earlier about that, it feels like musically you are creating your own world. You also do a lot of collaboration. How do you welcome other people into that world and work with them in making it real?
Well, if there's one rule for the world that I'm creating, or the world, I mean, I'm trying to actualize the world that I want to live in and that I want to be reality. And in that world, you're allowed to tell your story without judgment, and you're allowed to come in with your own experience. And the most important thing is that you're being authentic to yourself, and that authenticity is the thing that we value more than skill or precision. It's about living your authentic self and your authentic life. And so I love to work with people who do all kinds of things. And basically I just say, you know, what would you like to add to this? You know, what is your contribution? That's like a soup or a stew that we're all making together. And you bring some potatoes or you bring some parsley, like they're both valuable, and we want them and they're welcomed, and I want them. And I want to see what it is that your flavors will change in mine or bring out in mine. And that's always a fascinating process. But I don't give a lot of direction, because that kind of defeats the purpose of collaboration, I think.
When you come, you know, to the point where this album is out in the world and people are dancing at the show at the record bar and stuff like that, then it'll be, I'm guessing, at some point, time to think about what's next. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you were sitting in that same meeting where someone said, what could you do next? What do you want to do next? Anything. And you gave the answer before, go and record with some musicians in LA. What would your answer be now that you've done that?
Oh, gosh. I've been really fortunate to do a lot of amazing things. And, you know, where I want to kind of look next is really composing for large ensembles of musicians. And hopefully to, and I'm thinking particularly with strings or a more orchestral outfit, and like leaning into my classical training, and that's really what I would like to explore next, I think, is getting into playing with symphonies, writing for them, orchestras, I mean, and writing for them and singing in front of them. Yeah.
When you also talk about your journey being toward living more and more of your authentic life and becoming more and more comfortable living your most authentic life, what is still hard about that at this point? Because it's, I think from the outside, it would be easy to hear your story and be like, wow, I mean, this guy's made it. He's got nothing, like nothing to lose anymore. Like,
yeah. I try to always be somebody who's building bridges, and so therefore I try to be empathetic, and I try to listen and look at other people's stories. And you know, there are a lot of people, it's a very divisive time to be alive, and I think more so now than ever because of social media and because of the internet and how connected we are and the expectation of being connected. And so I don't ever want to be in a position where I'm trying to be divisive or trying to upset somebody or trying to be insensitive based on their own worldview or where they've come from. And
it sounds like maybe other people's feelings is
it gets hard. It impacts me. And so I try to it's a journey. We're all on a journey. And I think I want to make sure that I'm trying to build bridges rather than burn them.
What's your relationship with the church at this point?
I love a lot of what the church does for people, especially like the services that they provide, like support in so many different ways. But every church is just like a person, and every person is different, and there are evil people and there are great people.
Yeah, like the church.
Right. I mean, but there is a big, you know, big capital C church that's out there. But I think ultimately that's like, you know, how do you feel about humans right now? You know, like it's just, they're all different. And there are amazing communities, and there are ones that are toxic, and toxic in a bad way. And so I feel like, spirituality and connection to each other is always going to be important to me.
Well, congratulations on this new album. It's really exciting.
Thank you.
Our time is up. Calvin Arsenia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We talked to Calvin Arsenia back when his new album, LA Sessions, had just come out. You heard about his dreams to play with and write for orchestras. Now he's on a mission to buy an orchestral harp. We'll be sure to follow that story as it develops. But if you want to catch Calvin performing in person, you can do that on February 1st at Crown Center or February 15th at the Nelson. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, the Queen of Leotards lives here in Kansas City. That story is next. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and my next guest is a Kansas Cityan who was profiled in the New York Times. Her life and her work as a dancer led her to develop a better leotard. And not to be dramatic about this, but it sounds like her new and improved leotards are changing people's lives. Lisa Choles, owner of Elevé Dancewear, thanks for being here.
Hi, Gina.
The New York Times just called you the Leotard Queen. That is pretty crazy.
It's kind of a fun title.
It really is. Well, as a dancer yourself, what was wrong with leotards before? Ooh. And maybe still is wrong with many of the leotards out there.
I do think leotards are a lot better now, thank heavens. But back many, many years ago when I was still dancing, there was a point in time where leotards were very awkward. It's kind of strange because I'm tall and lean, and you would think that most dancers were lean and they would fit correctly. But I would go and try them on, and they would be kind of short in the torso and wide. And so when I'd put them on, they'd bubble in the back, or they'd be too short, and my, you know, it'd kind of fall down and not be supportive enough. And so those were the issues I was facing when I first started.
We don't think of professional dancers as people who are self-conscious about their bodies, but I guess the assumption there is that anyone who can put themselves out there like that is very confident. But the dancers quoted in this New York Times article and pictured looking incredibly fit, they all say that's not the case and that having a leotard that really works has made a difference.
Well, we spend all day in front of the mirror. And if you're judging yourself basically in tight-fitting clothing all day, you really see every flaw. And so if you don't have a leotard that's fitting quite right or it's not very supportive, it just doesn't make you feel as good. And so having something that is sort of compresses your body and is cute and fashionable, that really does help.
Tell me about your background, your personal story. As I mentioned, you came to this not as a fashion designer, but as a dancer.
I danced professionally from 18 all the way to 37, had a few kids in the middle of my career, and so I kind of been all over the place for a really long time through different dance fashions, as you could say. And so,
could you describe those? Because people who aren't in the dance world don't know that there have been eras of dance fashion.
Oh, there's definitely eras, you know, whether they're either low cut or high cut or... You know, back when I was a child, they didn't have a support bra put in. And so.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that.
Yes. And sometimes they were see-through.
We used to cut the tops of our tights mm-hmm. and put them on under our leotards
yeah.
so that the leg holes are where you put your arms.
Yes.
It was weird.
Yes. Yeah, so you cut out the crotch of your tights and I
put your head through there.
Yes. And that became your support bra. And so nowadays, most leotards come with a liner.
Wow.
I know. What a concept.
What else about your story? I mean, I am interested in the early interest in dance, like where it came from and how you felt in your body in the leotards in that moment.
Well, I started dance around 6 years old and gymnastics into tap, ballet, jazz, and kind of ballet is what stuck. And then I actually moved away from home when I was 15 and I loved ballet. I loved dancing. I could do it all day long. I went to regular high school and after we would rehearse from 3 to 9 o'clock. And then when I graduated from high school, I went and trained with San Francisco Ballet School. And I was there.
One of the best in the country.
Yes. And I was there on full scholarship for a year. And then I was lucky enough to get a job with Ballet West at 18. And so I started my career pretty young and pretty normal for that time. These days, it's changed a lot, and dancers aren't even starting their professional career until their 20s.
Huh.
Yeah, so it's – and with leotard fashion, you know, how it's changed, like, it's just been amazing how, like, the growth of how things fit and how dancers are – like, we get responses like the New York Times article. There was kind of a story between every dancer that was interviewed, the same thing of feeling self-conscious within themselves and then being able to wear great-fitting dancewear really changed that. And for my career, from when I started young until when I ended, I did mature because I was older, but my confidence level did extremely increase, mainly because I felt really good within myself.
You've mentioned this, but you have what is actually a pretty unusual story in the professional dance world in that you had two kids and kept dancing. Getting pregnant is often the end of a ballet dancer's career because of a combination of things, but including demands on the body for core strength, expectations for how a dancer's body looks that are not often satisfied by people who just had babies and a lot more. Can you talk to me about what that was like for you to stay in the game through all of that?
Yes. Well, back when I had my children in the late 90s, professional dancers, there were few that were having kids. Maybe principals were having kids and were allowed to come back, but most dancers did not get their job back. And thank heavens for unions and things like that that has changed in the times and the viewpoints of the directors have changed. I was lucky enough to audition here for Kansas City Ballet and the artistic director, William Whitener, was amazing. I was 28 and I came here and my kids were 1 and 2 and he changed my life because he gave me this job, which I thought I would never dance professionally in a company like this ever again. And I was extremely lucky and I feel blessed and honored that he trusted me to be able to continue dancing professionally and also be a mother.
I understand, though, that you got started kind of cobbling together different sizes of leotards and different styles of leotards to sort of Frankenstein them for your body after babies.
Yeah, so, I mean, the best thing you can do when you're trying to create your own dance line is kind of look at something that sort of fits you. And what I used to do is I would vintage shop and find these old leotards from the 70s because they were long and they kind of, I liked the way they fit. And of course, they were terrible. They were falling apart and had no elastic in the legs, but that made it easier to cut them up. And I would kind of take the pattern, place it on a piece of paper and kind of shape it. And I would test it out and kind of created my own sloper out of these leotards. And from there, I could go to different designs.
Patchwork 70s leotards does not sound like the most promising start.
Well, of course, that's just for a pattern. Of course, I took modern day fabrics, which were so much better than the old polyester fabrics that they had back then. And so now they stretch, they have so much more spandex. And, you know, I would basically cut my pattern so they were kind of a compression garment, so the way the stretch feels. And it was a lot of experimenting, but it was great. And, you know, once I retired in 2009, I started my company in 2010, and we started in the basement of my home. And it was kind of amazing. We had everything going. And I'm not sure if you know this, but I had a house fire, and it started in my patterning room, and it actually destroyed almost 90% of my patterns. And so then we had to start over. But, you know, now we're almost 10 years later, everything's done on computer. And so I pattern on my computer, and we're able to print these out, and we have a better record. And so if there was a fire, we wouldn't have that same problem.
Wow. You started thinking about a leotard that would be better for your body, but there are different body types out there. How do you think about what kind of a leotard bodies actually need?
Well, since we're mostly a dance company, you know, if you go into a ballet class, a lot of the dancers are the same size. Especially when I started, now almost 10 years later, we have recreational dance has expanded extremely, and so adult dancers are going with different body types, and that's where we're kind of reevaluating our patterns and trying to come up with larger sizes, and we're in that process right now. But back when I started, you know, most of the people in Kansas City Ballet who I made leotards for, because it did start off as professionals, we all had similar body types.
They looked like you.
Yeah, or maybe shorter. And so we had a shorter torso, but, you know, around the body, we were very similar.
And now that's changing. That's
it
really
is.
Interesting.
And we do kids. And so that's a whole nother, you know, group of body types that we have to, you know, create for and pattern for.
When you got started, did you see this really as it was going to be your second career?
No, not especially when I first started. I had no idea this would take me into where we are now. And when I retired, I had already been selling to friends and dancers and shipping boxes to other companies of people I knew. And when I retired, I was doing costuming for Kansas City Ballet.
So you were kind of like that friend who makes leotards.
Mm-hmm. I was the friend that makes, they used to call them Lisa's Leos. I said no to that name when I started my company. But it is cute, and I was honored that they would want to wear what I created. And, you know, so going from there to professional leotard making, it was really challenging to decide if I wanted to do costuming or dancewear, and I felt comfortable in dancewear, and I could stay in Kansas City. And so I did, and now we're in a 10,000-square-foot building manufacturing out of it, and I have lots and lots of employees, and it's just been an amazing, you know, growth for us.
What's the journey been like for you?
Ooh, I mean, the journey's been great, and I really could not do it without my amazing team that I have right now. I have over 35 employees, and they are the heart of Elevé. You know, I really cannot do this business without them. And as we expand into have our flagship store in New York this year, now that we're in the new year, you know, it's very exciting for all of us. As much as there's a lot of dance in Kansas City, it's not the mecca of the
I'm shaking
US.
My head. There's
I
not
know.
A lot of, there's no, there, da- there is dance
There is
in
dance,
City.
But yes, so we want to be able to be accessible to more dancers and be, I like to say, kind of run with the big boys, the other brands that are bigger, and kind of be available to our, you know, to the market and to the dancers that do want to go in and try on the leotard and see how it fits. So that was good news to hear that retail, though it's slowing down, we hope that we can still, it's not dying yet, because we really love for people to feel the fabrics, try them on, and because that's what makes the big difference.
Lisa Choles, owner of Elevay Dancewear and former dancer with the Kansas City Ballet, thank you so much for telling your story.
Thanks, Gina.
The New York Times has dubbed Lisa the Leotard Queen. You can share this morning's conversations with anyone who might have missed them. The link will be ready at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we've got the food critics coming in to talk about vegetarian options here in town with a focus on exceptional veggie burgers and the story of a veggie burger mastermind. Call in to tell us about the best meatless meals in Kansas City tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.